With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the very first Menna's Masterclass for 2023. And in this episode, I am joined by former Australian batter Phil Jakes. Phil rose through the ranks to burst into the New South Wales side as a powerful and punchy left-hand batter. Due to Hayden and Langer's imposing opening partnership record, he had limited opportunities at the highest level, but made his test debut in late 2005. Phil finished with an envious test and first-class record, averaging 47 at test level and 48 at first-class level. In 19 test innings, Phil passed 50 nine times with three centuries. Phil was recently the New South Wales coach from 2018 to 2022 and is now running the Phil Jakes Pro Cricket Academy, which runs private clinics and holiday camps in Sydney. And if you are interested in some of Phil's coaching, the links to that academy are in the episode notes. Now, Phil, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
How are you, Menna's? How are you, listeners?
Yeah, I'm doing really well. So I really want to go back through your career and sort of so many great moments. But, you know, I kind of want to start at the end and work back. You know, you retired from Australian cricket at the age of 32. And was it a back injury that in the end sort of made you sort of bow out a little earlier than some?
Yeah, I had a really serious back injury where I ended up having three surgeries, had a disc replacement in my back, and two sort of failed attempts, I guess, to fix that prior to that. I did get back playing and end up having three seasons in county cricket at the back end of my career. But after the rehab that I had, I really didn't see any opportunities at Australian level. The Australian selectors at the time were picking quite young. They weren't picking older players, and I felt like I needed a challenge at that point, and I wanted to go back and really enjoy my cricket and see see a little bit more of the world. And there was an opportunity to go and mentor a few younger players in England at Yorkshire at the time. Joe Root was coming through at Yorkshire, and Gary Balance and Johnny Bairstow, just to name a few. So it was a really exciting opportunity to work under Jason Gillespie as a coach, develop my coaching while I was still playing, and then be able to do club coaching in Australia in the Australian summer, so I could actually get some experience in coaching before I finished playing. I felt like I had probably about 3 years left in me at that time, and the back was starting to make things quite uncomfortable, even after it was fixed. You know, it wasn't overly pleasurable playing cricket at that point.
Really?
So just decided to go and enjoy the last few years that I was playing, in county cricket. Just play four-day cricket, really. Played a little bit of one-day cricket, but not very much. And just be able to really focus on first-class cricket and be able to contribute a little bit off the park as well.
That's a shame about the back. It's a bit like Michael Clarke, he was really uncomfortable at the end of his career. And I guess then, how sort of frustrating was it that, you'd been in such good form, Justin Langer and, Matty Hayden are sort of coming to the end of their career and then your kind of back goes, how did you sort of come to terms with that?
Yeah, well, I played for most of my Australian career with a bit of a back problem that I had to manage anyway. Right. And it was a day-to-day thing. I was getting up at 5:30 every morning to try and get my back ready to go, especially at the end of my Australian career. And it was sort of taking me three or four hours to get moving in the morning, which wasn't overly enjoyable. But when you work so hard to get to that level, you want that opportunity and you want to stay there for as long as you can. And I wish I'd kind of done a few of the things that I did when I had my back injury a little bit earlier, so I didn't get the back injury. You know, it's one of those things that you sort of learn and along the way. It was frustrating, you know, to sort of be behind two really champion players, you know, who did such a great job for Australia. You couldn't begrudge them their position, but it was disappointing, I guess, to be knocking the door down and then still not be able to get an opportunity. And then I do actually get an opportunity and I lose that because of the fact that I was injured at the time. There were some really good players around at the time as well who were in great form, and it was an easy selection to make really for the selectors to pick someone that was 100% fit rather than someone that was, I guess, 80, 85% fit.
Yeah, part of the problem, Phil, was he spent so much time out in the middle piling up the runs all over the place. No wonder your back was a bit sore. Your parents are English, is that right? So you had an English passport?
Yeah, Mum and Dad were both English. Dad was from Sheffield and Mum was from Manchester. They moved out in the late 1960s to sort of forge a new life out in Australia. And
10-pound poms?
No, they weren't actually. They were. Dad was headhunted by BHP. Okay. He was a metallurgist and came out and got a job in Port Kembla, and I grew up in Wollongong down there. That was sort of where I had my childhood for, you know, the first 18, 19 years of my life. I got a British passport as a result of them obviously being English.
And when you were growing up in Wollongong, was it sort of that typical Aussie experience, you know, down at the beach, playing cricket? I don't know, did you play footy in the winter? Was that kind of the vibe?
Yeah, I played a little bit of footy at school, but I was mainly into my basketball. I was a rep basketball player when I was younger I stopped growing. everyone started to grow about 3 feet taller than me. Played a bit of tennis as a kid, and cricket. Cricket was always my thing. I wasn't an overly cricket family. My dad did play cricket, but you know, he wasn't overly into cricket. He was more into his soccer, which I played as a youngster as well. Then I got into cricket because my friends played it, enjoyed my childhood. I guess just in Fig Tree, growing up, sort of up in the hills, up in Fig Tree, and yeah, like we used to make our own fun up there. We go to the beach every now and then, but you know, there was obviously some really nice landscape and countryside around there too. You know, we sort of played with the local kids in the area and made our own fun, making tree houses as all kids do.
And did you sort of realize around that age that you know you're pretty good at this batting thing when you started to sort of playing, you know, games in your teenage years? Did it sort of, you know, really start to click in then?
Yeah, I was I was always a decent player. I played a year up in rep cricket the first couple of years I played, and then, you know, sort of in my own age, I was the captain of the team and worked my way through the ranks there. But I was always a bit of a slogger, to be honest. Right. up until I got a little bit of coaching and off a guy called Anthony Maguire, who was a second 11 player in New South Wales, and he was from Wollongong originally, and I hooked up with him for a couple of years, and you know, he sort of taught me the basics of, you know, how to keep the ball on the ground, basically. And then I sort of honed my craft as I got into Sydney ranks and learned how I best went about it, with my game, along with the help of a lot of good people at Sutherland Cricket Club.
Yeah, so you bashed the door down and you made your way into the New South Wales side, I think in the 2001 season. And, you know, when you went into that side, I mean, it was a great era of New South Wales cricket. You know, you still had the War brothers, Lee, McGrath, McGill and Clark were in the 11 you made your debut in. I guess, you know, what was it like, you know, stepping up from grey cricket into that sort of star-studded Blues lineup?
Yeah, incredibly, incredibly strong team. And, you know, like I think a few years prior, I had those guys on my wall. You know, you're bumping into guys like Steve Waugh. Steve Waugh was my captain for a year, and he was one of the guys I looked up to as a kid. And, you know, Mark Taylor was around the hallways every now and then, and he wasn't playing at that point, but he was still around, and he was another one of my idols. And yeah, you're just playing with these guys that you see playing on TV, and yeah, it's a bit surreal really when you first start playing at that level, but and a little bit daunting as well, I'm not going to lie. You know, you always have that question mark whether you feel like you're up to it or not, and you just want to make an impression and show how good you are. And you know, I was sort of took me a while to get established in the New South Wales side. I think I played one game at the end of that year, and then, you know, I was called up morning of the game in that game on my debut and batted at number 10.
What was that like? So you just like flew up there that morning and sort of get off the plane and straight to the ground?
Yeah, I was living in Wollongong at the time as well, so I had to drive up the F6 as well on the morning to get to the airport. Jumped on a plane, and I didn't get there until lunchtime because they didn't take, like, they only took 12 players at that point, and they had a spin bowler at the Gabba as their 12th man. And
silly.
And one of the batters went down morning of the game with gastro. So I think it was Shane Lee, I think. I had to come into the team because they needed a batsman. And I think I got there and we were 8 for 60 on the morning. So I went straight out at lunchtime and we were 8 down batting at number 10, which was definitely a new position for me. I don't think I'd ever batted 10 before. And then I opened in the second innings of that game. But it was a bit chaotic, I'm not going to lie. I got dropped off at the wrong entrance to the ground. I had to walk all the way around the Gabba, and I was listening to the game on the radio coming from the airport, and I was just hearing wicket after wicket fall, and I was like, I'm not going to get a bat here, because we were in a bit of a collapse. And ended up getting I think I got 40 I think on debut. And but I didn't get another opportunity until the last game of the next year, and then didn't play again the following year. So I played 2 games in 3 years, and sort of had that feeling of, well, am I good enough or not? What do they think of me? Do I need to move states, or I'm just not going to make it? But then was lucky to get an opportunity after that to have a decent run at it.
What was it then, do you think, that clicked for you at the top level? Like, when do you think you turned the corner?
Well, I was making runs in second 11 cricket and doing quite well, but there just wasn't any opportunities. And I'd started opening the batting. I'd always been a 3 or a 4, but opened the batting for some more opportunities. And then I was lucky enough to get an opportunity to go play county cricket at Northampton, which because I had a British passport and I hadn't played the year before for New South Wales, I was eligible to play, and they needed a batsman. And I'd originally signed up to play league cricket. I wasn't going to play county cricket. And then a chance sort of meeting while I was coaching, actually, at an indoor centre. I was coaching some little kids. There was a guy from Northampton there, and he ended up hooking me up with the CEO, and I'd signed that next night, that evening. So really, really chance meeting. And, you know, a stroke of luck gave me the opportunity to go play county cricket to then learn and play with Michael Hussey and under Kepler Vessels as the coach, who were two really good left-hand players, and, you know, really good education for me to learn how to make runs and make big scores. And I started to do that in county cricket, had a really dominant year in my first year over there, got 1,400 and something runs at 60, and it made the people in New South Wales sort of stand up and take notice a little bit more. And they gave me a ring and said, we're going to give you an opportunity to have a good run at it, and pick you in the team at the start of the season. And at that point, I had England kind of pulling me one direction, going, well, you know, you can qualify in another 3 years' time, or you can go back to Australia and have an opportunity with New South Wales and potentially play for Australia. That was kind of what I had, and I felt like Australia was a mile away at that point because I'd only played 2 first class games and in Australia, and didn't really feel like I was any good, to be honest. Then I got an opportunity and took it, and then I was playing for Australia in 18 months after that.
Right. And were you at all tempted by the offer from England? I mean, knowing how strong the Australian side was at the time, you know, when you looked at the team, did you think, well, maybe England would be a better fit?
Well, I think career-wise, it was definitely an option. I had a county that wanted to sign me long term. at that point, I was year to year with New South Wales and unsure of whether, you know, where I really sat and where I was going to get an opportunity. But I think the call from Steve Rickson that I got when I was overseas to say, hey, we're going to give you an opportunity to establish yourself and we're going to give you a really good run at it was enough for me to say, well, I want to truly back myself in here. And if I can make it in New South Wales, then I can play for Australia. And if not, well, you know, that I'm just not good enough. And, you know, I think my heart always said Australia. My head was leaning towards England just from a finance perspective and career perspective. But, you know, the heart took over and I really wanted to have a crack at playing for Australia. And I had the right opportunity in New South Wales and it was up to me whether I took it or not.
Are you still happy with the decision you made all these years later?
Yeah, no regrets at all. Like to be able to wear the baggy green cap for one test for me was a dream come true and was something I'd always dreamt about, didn't think would happen. You know, and I got to play 11 games in a really champion team with some of the greats of the game. Had some really good success at that level. And yeah, no regrets really. You know, I still got to play 9 years of county cricket you know, have a really decent career over there. And, you know, I sort of always made a pact with myself that I'd have no regrets and no what ifs in my life. I'd always just back myself in and then you don't live with regrets after that. And I felt like I did that.
Oh, what a fantastic attitude. Yeah, you're wearing the three lions. I mean, that would be pretty tough.
That would be hard. I think I would have had a rash that would never have gone away.
just a couple of things. On that experience of playing in England, you know, I often think, you know, something that's been lost is that, you know, a young Australian batter going over to England and playing league cricket or county cricket if you're lucky enough to get a contract and kind of learning the craft of batting and scoring runs. And, you know, in English cricket, the conditions vary from week to week. You're playing all sorts of games. I think it would be great if more young players from Australia could get over there.
Yeah, I think that's been the biggest change, I think, since I finished playing is how hard it is now to get into county cricket. They have softened it a little bit and letting big bash players to get over there if they play a certain amount of games. But the criteria is definitely harder to get into county cricket. Back in my playing days, literally if the county wanted you, they could sign you. And, right. You know, so I think it kind of left it open to be able to play at whatever level, providing they wanted you to play there. I think English cricket did that to kind of give their own players a few more opportunities. But, you know, when you're really talking about one or two players in a team, I think it makes the whole system stronger by having the better players playing. And, yeah, it was certainly an unbelievable education to go and play in England. I played one season of club cricket over there as well when I was 18. And then obviously 9 years of county cricket. As you said, you just get to play on all conditions, all different weather types. You know, the standard's strong, you know, and I think if you can learn how to bat on those wickets, you can learn how to bat on any wickets. And, you know, it certainly makes you play, you know, a better game plan for longer. And I think it is lost from our system. And I think, you know, the more players that can get over there and experience that and play regular week-to-week cricket, I think it's a bonus. They play a lot more cricket than what we play in all conditions. And, yeah, I think it just sets you up for success.
And usually as well, if you're the Aussie going over there, there's an expectation you'll do well. So you also learn to deal with that pressure of being almost the pro and having to sort of live up to that. So I think, you know, it has been lost. Totally agree. You mentioned before sort of, you know, playing with Mike Hussey and Kepler Vessels. And you mentioned, I think, Anthony Maguire, your coach before. Any other sort of really big influences or anyone, you know, sort of grab you when you went into the New South Wales side and sort of give you a few tips?
Yeah, I had a guy called Martin Carroll who was a guy at Sutherland that was, you know, like he was my eyes when I played. He's now actually working for my academy, which is unreal that we've sort of gone full circle, that he was sort of my mentor and my coach and helped me through my playing days. And, you know, he was the sort of guy that whenever I was in town, he'd come and throw balls for free. Like I think I threw him a couple of beers every now and then. And, you know, he really, like, he didn't want anything for it except for me to do well. And, you know, and I could never repay him enough for the time that he gave me. And if it was just a simple phone call or throwing balls and I'm home, he was always there, always really helped me. And he'd spot whenever I was struggling a little bit and would be able to fix it literally over the phone. I'd go and way work on it and then invariably scored runs after we'd spoken, and he'd just get my head right. And he was a massive influence. And as I said, it's fantastic that you know, he can come and work for me now, and you know, in my business, and we can, you know, help the next generation of kids as well.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and I'll be back with more from Phil Jakes.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Welcome back to Menna's Masterclass. I'm Menna's, and I'm joined by former Australian batter Phil Jakes. All right, I want to talk about your entry into the Australian side, that moment when you got the baggy green. So you were called up into the Australian side in 2005 at the MCG Test against South Africa. Now, I'm gathering it wasn't the sort of rushed affair that your first class debut was?
No, it was the longest week of my life, actually.
Really?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think the expectation is something that you can never really get your head around. I felt like I, you know, was completely ready cricket wise. Mentally, I felt really strong. I was making runs. I was in good form. I scored about 10,000 first class runs at that point. And, you know, it was a really good time to be picked. I think I was coming off 400s, I think, in first class and one day cricket. And, if you're ever going to get picked, that's when you want to get picked for, you know, your debut. But yeah, it was a long week. It was, you know, like the expectation that you have when you come into a Boxing Day test, and just the amount of eyes that are on you. I don't think I've ever trained in front of any more than about 5 people before. And, you know, you're training at the MCG and there's 1,000 people watching the nets, you know, and you know, you might have a media interview with 1 or 2 people, you know, in a first class game. You know, they have scrums of 30 or 40 at a Boxing Day, you know, where they talk, everybody wants to talk to you. And it was just like, you know, like this big expectation. And, you know, like the night before the game, I got 1,000 text messages off people that, you know, pretty much everybody that I'd ever met in my life had text me, because I had the same number since I was 17. And, you know, like, I think, you know, for those people, they just wanted to wish me luck. And, you know, for me, it was just like, you're just hearing this ding coming in all the time. And it's like, wow, okay. Like, I knew they were watching and I knew people would be out there watching, but like, it's literally everyone I know has texted me today. And so like getting your head around that, trying to get some sleep, calm yourself down. Like, I don't think I slept much through that week. It was a bit of a blur, really. And I think everybody that's debuted for Australia, I think we'd probably say something similar, but, you know, it probably took me a couple of tests, I think, to really get my head around that. But yeah, like an unbelievable experience, 77,000 people at the MCG, you know, facing the first ball of a test match. It was insanely good, great rush, you know, and really good memories.
So was it Justin Langer you were replacing? Was he injured or was it Haydos?
Yeah, Justin Langer, yeah.
So you walked out with the big Queenslander Hayden to open the batting. Wow, what a day! So you know, you come into that side. You know, Ponting's the skipper. You know, so I guess for those listening, I mean, it's after the 2005 Ashes. It was a big summer. I think just before that, Australia was leading into a World Test Championship final or a World 11. So there was a bit going on. You come into Ponting's team. You know, I guess, I think I read you didn't even had never met Ricky until you went in there. You know, I mean, what's it like? You walk in and it's, you know, you mentioned the New South Wales side, but this is like, okay, now it's really like everywhere you look, there's a, you know, a legend of the game.
Yeah, insanely good team. I think they were, you know, in the midst of a record run at that point of wins as well. Very daunting. Hadn't met too many people. It was Christmas time, so everyone had their families there. I was kind of on my own a little bit. had that feeling, yeah, that feeling of, well, this isn't really my team. And I didn't feel that sort of for a little while. But you just try and come in and be yourself and, you know, be the best version of you and try and help the team win. And, you know, I didn't have the most successful first test, but it was, yeah, it was still a great experience and unbelievable team to play with, you know, like playing with the great Shane Warne. You know, experiencing Christmas Eve at his place was pretty epic as well. Yeah, like, I don't know. It was quite a famous thing. But yeah, like just unbelievable memories, really.
Tell me a little bit about Ricky Ponting as a skipper, because you know, one thing that I think that doesn't maybe permeate outside the Australian team was how much he was kind of the heart and soul of that team for so long. Just give me a bit of an insight on what it was like playing under him and with him.
Yeah, unbelievable leader. You know, he was a pure winner. He just, you know, there was an expectation of winning and an expectation of getting the job done under Ricky. And he completely held everybody to account and to the standards that were expected of the Australian cricket team. And that was probably the thing that stood out to me the most was that, you know, that the expectation, that everybody knew the expectation. And it wasn't a fear thing. It was just like, you know, we're good enough and we're going to expect to win every time we walk on that park. And this is, you know, it's just what we do as an Australian cricket team. We just get the job done and we get the win. You know, he was an excellent, like an excellent captain as far as the knowledge that he brought. You know, I think tactically he was really, really strong. If you were struggling, he'd sense it. He'd come and have a chat with you. He'd come and have a take you out for a coffee or have a, you know, spend a bit of time to get to know you. Yeah, really, really good leader.
So you said your debut was okay, 2-28, but it didn't take you too long. At the end of November 2007, you made your first test century, 100 against Sri Lanka. Must have been the culmination of, you know, all your childhood dreams coming true.
Yeah, it was actually. Like it was an unbelievably special day, and I think I butchered 100 in my second test. I was on about 66 in Bangladesh in the test match that Jason Gillespie got 200. I was batting with Jason at the time, and I remember walking off and just going, oh, I've thrown away 200 there, literally thrown away 200. It was the flattest wicket of all time against an okay attack. And I got out caught on the boundary at deep mid-wicket. Absolute slog. Went back to my slogging days in Wollongong, I think. Yeah, I was really disappointed to miss out in that game because I felt like it was a chance to really establish myself and potentially stay there. And then I had to wait another year basically for my third opportunity. And when I got into that team, I was like, right, this is actually my spot now because Justin had retired and it was an opportunity to really, you know, establish myself. And there was nothing in the world that was going to stop me getting 100 that day. I hadn't thought beyond 100 and I ended up butchering it after I got 100 and got out about four balls later, I think. Yeah, like I was so determined. I think I was 36 balls on zero at the Gabba on a bit of a green wicket. And there was just nothing in my mind saying that I wasn't worried about the fact that I hadn't scored a run. I was just like, I'm getting 100 today. I'm going to set this team up for a good result and establish myself in this team. And it was just probably the most single-minded innings I think I've ever been involved in, as far as like, I'm going to get runs. I'm going to do it my way. And whatever it takes, you know, I'm going to get 100. It was an unbelievable feeling. I was out there with Mike Hussey at the time, who I'd obviously played with at Northampton as well, and incredibly special moment. I don't remember too much about what I did. I think I ran around with my arms in the air for about 2 minutes, and then I remember Mike giving me a massive cuddle and my helmet almost flipping around at the back. It was just like all over the place because we just tackled each other basically because we were both really. He was happy for me and I was, you know, off over the moon to get 100. And as I said, I don't think I quite settled my emotions afterwards and threw it away not too long after, but yeah, unbelievable experience here.
I love hearing that bloody mindedness that you just weren't going to get. You're going to have to be carried off that. You were going to get 100. But, you know, you talk about sort of the spot being yours. Well, I mean, you nailed the spot because, you know, at one point you went on a run scoring six scores over 50 at test level. You know, so it's been done seven times by six people. So you're sort of tied seventh for that record. But, you know, that sort of consistency opening the batting is really hard to achieve. And as I said at the top, you know, you passed 59 times in 19 test innings. So, you know, you must be really satisfied with your returns in those 11 tests.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I'd got everything out of myself, as I said, except for me throwing away my 100 when I got my first 100, and potentially the missed one in Bangladesh. But outside of that, yeah, like I felt like I did my job for the team, yeah, you always look back as a batter and go, oh, you know, I could have made a few more here or I could have made a few more there, and potentially I could have. But yeah, the consistency level of how many starts I got at that level and actually got in and did a decent job for the team was rewarding, and it was just good to show people how I could play at that level. I felt like I could do it at that level. I felt like I'd been making runs for a long time, and yeah, I think I sort of worked out mentally what I needed to do. You know, after the first couple of games where I felt like I floundered a little bit. I did a lot of work with my sister, who's a psychologist as well. So we hadn't really spoken much about cricket up until that point, and then I sort of leaned on her a little bit for some mental advice because I felt like I really needed it, and she was a massive help for me in being able to develop the skills to be able to block out that external noise and be able to deal with the inner voice that, you know, just chirps away in the background as you're batting. Because there's a lot of time in cricket and a lot of time to think. And, you know, coming up with some decent strategies around that is the key to being successful, I think.
Well, that's really interesting that you sort of went down that path. I mean, was it that sort of, as you said, was it sort of trying to come to grips with that extra, you know, tension at the top level and also the extra doubt that comes with that?
Yeah, I think it was just being able to sort of control that expectation and control that noise, and just to get the absolute most out of myself. I felt like I could do it at that level, but I couldn't do it the way I was doing it. So I needed to have some strategies, and I shifted my preparation a little bit, you know, with regards to how I prepare mentally for games. I shifted my training methods a little bit to be really focusing on how I start my innings and being calm when I walked out, you know, which was an adjustment of, you know, just spending 15, 20 minutes of checking in with myself and making sure that I was really calm and that I was clear on my plan. And, you know, I think mornings sometimes you can get caught up in everything else rather than just what do you need to do to prepare. And yeah, after I'd experienced, I suppose, the rushing and the hustle bustle of test cricket, I worked out some pretty decent methods that worked for me. And every time I walked on the park from then on, I felt like I was going to score runs, and that's a nice place to be in, because then it's on you rather than the doubt or something getting in the way of you being able to perform. It was literally on your skill. It was the skill versus the bowler, and that was it.
How lucky of your the people you're coaching now to be able to, for you to pass this on to them. So in your test career, you know, you mentioned, I sort of looked through the tests you played. There was a couple of famous ones. You mentioned the Dizzy 200 test match, April 2006. I don't know, is it like one of the high points of Australian cricket, or, you know, is it regrettable that now 17 years later, Dizzy will bring up that 200 at just every opportunity?
I used to travel to games with Dizzy when he was coaching at Yorkshire, and I heard a lot of stories about the 200. And even though I was there, I still heard the stories about the 200. But it was an unbelievable innings. Really, I don't think we'll ever see that again. Like, you never say never in history, but like for a genuine tail end batter to get 200 in a game is insane, really.
Yeah, he had no shots. How did he score? I still can't believe he scored that many runs.
Yeah, like, I mean, he was 100 off over 300 balls, and then his second 100 was a run a ball. It was insane. You know, like, he, and as you said, he didn't have any shots. He had a flick off his legs and a, I don't even know what else.
Really rubbing your nose but, there too. You'd given away your innings at 66.
It was a long couple of days, I tell you. Having sitting down and already thinking I should have got 200, and then watching Dizzy go about it. Like, Dizzy's a great mate, and it was unbelievable to watch. And as I said, like, he wrote his history, and I don't think you'll ever see a guy get 200 and then not play their next test as well, which is what happened with Dizzy. Unbelievable story, really. Unbelievable to be a part of it.
Big regret, I reckon, Ponting sending in a night watchman. And you also played in, it's not such a fun test, was the Monkey Gate test at the SCG in January 2008. It's a famous victory by Australia, Michael Clarke taking 3 wickets at the end there. But, you know, mired in controversy around allegations against Harbhajan Singh, what he allegedly said to Andrew Simons. I mean, you know, that test has, I don't know, you know, it's got some really dark connotations now with around the way the sort of some of the players were treated afterwards. I mean, I guess what was that test like to play in? It mustn't have been very pleasant.
No, I was a little bit removed from the actual chat on the field, but I saw there was quite a heated discussion on the ground, and I remember walking past Matt Hayden and just saying, "Mate, what happened there?" And he goes, he goes. Harbhajan just called Andrew a monkey, and I was just like, "Oh wow, okay, that's not great." We're going to hear more about this. And the players were in the sheds. The players that actually heard it and they were around it were in the sheds until after 1 o'clock, and it was like day two of the game or something. So it was middle of the game, and they're in the change rooms until after midnight, which was less than ideal. Mm. And then there was, like threats of the tour being cancelled and all these sort of things happening. You try not to let it distract you and try and just keep doing your job. But there was a lot of stuff that went on, I think, behind the scenes that that did leave a sour taste in a lot of those players' mouths, I think. But as you said, it was an unbelievable test match. It was I think Michael Clarke got given, he got thrown the ball as an absolute Hail Mary play by Ricky, really. The game is going nowhere. It looks like it was petering out to a draw, and it was like a last chance. All right, have a go, pup. And then he goes and gets 3 wickets, really quick fire, and we win the test match. And I remember there was criticism about us celebrating that test match on the field as well at the time, because it felt like we won the World Cup. It really did, like actually being a part of it, because we felt like we were no chance. And then all of a sudden, we won this test match, and all the emotions of the last 4 days, 5 days, just all hit everybody, I think. And it was just such a good moment as far as from a team perspective to win a test match like that. And then we copped criticism in the media for that as well. And it was just it was one of those things where it felt like we couldn't do anything right at that point as a team. And I think it. Potentially a little bit of tall poppy syndrome, I think, with the Australian public and Australian media, maybe. I don't know. Maybe we did carry on a bit. I don't know. But it felt like we just won an unbelievable test match, and we celebrated it accordingly,
I think it was Peter Roebuck at the time called for Ricky Ponting to be sacked as Australian skipper. Well, what a test match to play in. I always remember Andrew Simons, the late great Andrew Simons, 160 odd in that match, a brilliant innings. I think he got a bit of a lucky one where he might have edged one and given not out, and it seemed to rub up the Indians the wrong way. But great win. You mentioned Michael Clarke, another one of, I asked you about Ponting before, but Clarke, great leader, great batter, someone, you would have played with a hell of a lot, but also in a bit of an enigma, all I've gleaned is honestly that maybe he's a little bit more self-obsessed than some other cricketers at the time. What was he like to play with?
Michael was an unbelievable talent, great batsman, I didn't really play under him much as a leader, so I'm not really sure how he was from a captaincy perspective. But you know, he knew the game inside out. You know, incredibly dedicated cricketer. I know that, you know, a lot of people see the blonde hair and the earrings and the, you know, and all that sort of stuff. That was just him expressing himself. He wanted to, you know, he had an interest in fashion and interest in that sort of stuff. And I think that was the beauty of that era, was there were so many individuals within that team that, you know, like that had their own personalities and could be themselves. And I never had a problem at all with Michael. I you know, I thought he was a really good player, a good teammate, and you always knew that, yeah, he would he'd try and win the game for Australia. And, you know, immensely competitive guy, and you know, and really talented with the ball too, as he showed in that test match, in the Monkey Gate test match, being able to come on and, you know, and get wickets for the team. I think he got a 6 for a test level, which
six for,
you
know, nine.
Is unbelievable. Yeah, like unbelievable, really. You know, for a batsman of his class to be able to come and do that with the ball as well. Great fielder, you know, so many run outs for Australia as well.
I imagine good to bat with, because good running between the wickets, turn the strike over.
Yeah, absolutely. Always looking to score, always looking to put pressure on the bat, on the bowler. And yeah, just a real competitive guy, and you know, had an unbelievable career for Australia.
Absolutely. I hope you're enjoying this Manners Masterclass. We'll be back with more in a moment.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You're listening to Manners Masterclass. I'm Manners, and I'm joined by Phil Jakes. What about some of the bowlers you faced at the highest level? Sort of, you know, Kumble, Sean Pollock, Lasith Malinga. I mean, who were some of the toughest ones that you came across?
Yeah, some really... yeah, some good bowlers in that era. I didn't last too long with Sean Pollock. He got me out pretty quickly. Mackay Nantini was hard work for left-handers. Really strange angle. It felt like it was sort of, he was almost bowling it off the pitch and running it across you all the time. And he was very, very tough to face. And Shane Bond, I think he ruined my one-day career. He was... you know, really, really quick bowler. Had his injury problems and probably didn't play as many games for New Zealand as what he could have done. But every time he did, he was hard work for the Australians. He had a great record against Australia, and you know, swung the ball both ways at really good pace. Incredibly hard to face. Yeah, some really good bowlers. Over, you know, Dale Steyn was a good bowler. Yeah, like Mira Lithuanian, like I scored a couple of runs against, like a few runs against him, but I think I picked one ball that he bowled, I think, genuine. And then I played it, and I was like, I'd done so much homework on reading him, and I felt like, yeah, I've got him now. I've seen it. I've got him. I know which way he's bowling it. And then he bowled me one that I thought was exactly the same, and I missed it by a foot and a half. And I was like, oh, my God. I need to sweep now. And I didn't want to sweep because we were playing at the Gabba on a bouncy wicket. But I was like, if I don't sweep, I'm not going to last long here. So he was an unbelievable bowler. And you could hear the ball fizzing down at you when he bowled it. Put so many revs on the ball. Yeah, some really
who
good.
Who do you
really
think had more revs on the ball, Warner or Morley?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. Like, I only faced Warney in a one-day game. He was just incredibly smart. I didn't face him in a longer form of the game. So,
lucky.
Thankfully, yeah. I felt like I tried to line him up about five or six times trying to get a boundary towards the back of the innings, and it was like he knew what I was going to do. Incredibly smart. But the noise that Mira Lithuanian's ball made was, yeah, like it was like a spitting cobra at you, and it was like hissing as it was coming down, and I'd never experienced anything like that before.
Wow. All right, Phil, now to wrap this up, I want to talk about sort of the end of the career, your career and your coaching. But before we get into that, I don't want to leave off the fact that you scored the highest score on debut by an Aussie in one day international cricket, 94. So good day. I remember that innings very well. You came out and just blasted that new ball straight away. You got that little notch on the belt.
Yeah, I think Phil Hughes overtook that, I think, a few years later. But at the time, he did. He got 100, I think, on the bit, which was amazing as well. And he was a fantastic cricketer as well. And, massive loss for the game with what happened with him. But to get 94 on debut, it was an unbelievable feeling, really. It was really hot, I remember. And we were playing indoors, and they shut the roof to sort of, I think, to try and make it less hot, but I think it made it even hotter. It was over 40.
Series. That was a bizarre series of a tie, and it was weird.
Yeah, yeah. We had some really good battles with that South African team in that era, and I think it was one of the first games at the now is Marvel Stadium at the time, and. Yeah, it was one of those games where I just felt like, I felt like I could hit the ball where I wanted to. I was in the complete zone. I felt really focused, and then ended up getting given out off my back shoulder, a bouncer. I actually still didn't hit it, and the umpire actually apologized to me straight after. He just went, "Oh, I think I stitched you up there, mate." And he was a guy that I knew from county cricket. He was an English umpire. He goes, "Oh, I think I've just watched the footage back, and I think I stitched it up there." And I was like, never a nice thing to say did. Straight after you get out. Unbelievable.
Yeah, you spoke about Jason Gillespie scoring 200 in his last test match. Well, I mean, you have the distinction of your last test innings was 108. And I'm gathering when you sort of walked off, you probably had no idea that would be your last test innings.
No, not at all. Really, I felt like I'd done enough to sort of establish my spot. I'd had a bit of a lean run in the West Indies or a bit of a slow start to that series, but finished the series with a 70 and 100, and I think maybe a 40 as well. I felt like I'd done enough to establish my place. But fortunately, when I came around to India, I had a niggle in my back, and Simon Kadich had come off an unbelievable Shield season, and he also made 100 in that test match as well, and replacing Matt Hayden, who was injured at the time, and then Matt Hayden had to come back in, and they decided they wanted to give Simon the opportunity, and to be honest, I think. Like my back wasn't there anyway. I did enough to get on the tour, but the travel had flared it up, and it got worse by sitting on the sidelines and actually not being up and around and moving. And by the second test, I was home getting back surgery, and I think by the end of that second test, I'd flown out, and that was it. Never played again. It was a really strange one. I didn't think that would be my last at all, but. When you're out for 11 months, a lot of people catch up and a lot of people go past you. And, that was unfortunately what happened with my back. And I did play my last test match and got 100 in that game.
Went out on top, Phil. I like it. And the same with first class cricket in 2014 in your last match, 77 and 79 in your last match. So, although you sort of clearly were battling through, I mean, it actually sounds really debilitating what you had to go through and the fact that, you see players now playing, into their late 30s, but you really just, that was never an option for you. So, went out on top, great career, congratulations. I mean, it's a fantastic story, a boy from the south of Sydney rising to the top level, doing it all around the world. I mean, it is, congratulations. So you should be immensely proud of what you've achieved. But then you decided to move into coaching. What was it? You sort of said, you're talking about career, you'd always been interested in it. What is it that you like about, mentoring and coaching?
Yeah, well, I ended up giving the cricket away because I got up at an opportunity to step into coaching. I was, as you said, I was playing good cricket at that point and was enjoying it. But the reason I was in England was to develop my coaching, and then I got an opportunity to come back and be a Pathways coach with New South Wales and their batting coach. So it was an opportunity I couldn't really refuse, and they needed me right then. It was in July when I interviewed for the role, and that was my last season with Nottingham. I'd actually arranged to have a mid-season break to go home and do that interview because I knew that it was coming up. And then they offered me the job, and that, so I called curtains on my career to be able to take up that job. And yeah, the thing about coaching I love is just to be able to help others get better and be able to impart whatever knowledge I've picked up along the way on the next level, and see them be able to play out their dreams and be able to, achieve what they want to achieve within the game. And that's something that I'm still really, really passionate about. I'm now working in my academy to do that with the younger kids, as opposed to professional players. But I still enjoy working with elite players. I love my time with Queensland and with New South Wales as well. Helping those professionals become better players and better people along the way, and hopefully have given them some sort of positive impact on their careers. And that's all I can really ask for. And that's why I'm in the game.
Well, I used to do a lot of holiday coaching as well. There's a former England international, Barry Knight, that used to run a lot of camps in Sydney. So I used to work with a lot of kids in the holidays like you're doing now. And it is very satisfying. It's very rewarding to be at that sort of, that just base level where they just love the game. They just want to hit balls. It is actually, it feeds the soul almost.
Yeah, absolutely it does. And, I'm working with kids from the age of 7 right up until adults, and to be able to have that broad range of people coming through my doors, they have their own challenges and their own times in their lives where you're navigating different things along the way, personally off the park as well as at cricket. And to see them sort of be able to learn a skill for the first time and then be able to hone that skill and take their games to another level, as they sort of get in that 12, 13-year-old age group, and then be able to guide them when they're a bit older, when, the hormones are racing, and be able to, having all sorts of distractions off the park and keep them focused on their cricket and show them that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and that they can actually make something of themselves within the game of cricket if they want to do that, is great. And if they don't want to be professional athletes, and, they can still enjoy their cricket more by getting that coaching and being the best version of themselves and being, the best players they can be. And, that's what I get up for in the morning. That's what I love doing. And it's just great to see smiles on the faces when they hit a shot for the first time or improve a shot that they've been struggling with for a long time.
Yeah, you're right about whether they go on with cricket or not, but it's just great for young kids to have that sort of, learn about, what it is to practice and, all the sort of, take advice and, they can apply that into any sort of path they go into. You're the New South Wales head coach from 2018 to 2022, won a Marsh One Day Cup and a Marsh Sheffield Shield, but then you were let go at the end of 2022 after a disappointing start to this current season. I guess from your point of view, what were the challenges that led to your sacking?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of challenges in that head coach position. I've had a little bit of time to think about it, and we weren't far away in those games. There was a few circumstances with conditions and, a few players were out of form at the wrong time that were key players within our team. A few of our younger guys probably just took a little bit longer than what they would normally to really establish themselves within a team. And that ultimately led to my dismissal. And, I have any hard feelings at all to New South Wales cricket. They've given me everything throughout the course of my career and even post-career, giving me opportunities to coach there. And, I can only wish them all the best. And, I'd, I'd, you know, I, as far as from a coaching perspective, I don't have too many regrets with that. You know, there's a few things I would have done differently going forward, but you know, you live and learn in this game, and you know, it is a fickle game, and it moves really fast. And as you said, we had lots of success. We made finals in every year that I was there. You know, in one form or the other, won a couple of titles, and had some real success. We had a slow start to the year, and then we still didn't, you know, really have a great back end of the year after I was gone either. So I think there, you know, there needs to be some change there, and there needs to, you know, be, you know, some better performances for a state the size of New South Wales should be performing really well, and we should be producing players that are playing for Australia. And I think the talent's there. I don't think we've got the wrong personnel. I think just need a little bit of luck and a little bit of self-belief, and I think they'll turn things around there.
I'm curious about your point of view, but I've had, you know, some great former New South Wales cricketers on this podcast, and had a really good chat with Gavin Robinson last year, and he spoke about sort of players taking real responsibility for their own game, and that, you know, at some point when you go out there, the onus is on you, and you have to work out, you know, how you're going to perform at that highest level. And, you know, was it frustrating for you that, you know, the players you were working with couldn't quite get there?
Yeah, I mean, it is frustrating when you're not quite kicking along, I guess, and you're not feeling that that belief and that expectation. I think I spoke about with that Australian team that I played in. There was an expectation and a standard that was set that it was your job to win this game, and you were the most important person in the team, no matter who you were. And when you had the bat or the ball in your hand, it was your job to get the job done, not leave it up to somebody else. And I guess there was that little feeling of, you know, starting to take that, but then not really running with it and winning games of cricket. You know, there were so many games where we'd set the game up beautifully and done the hard work and just didn't quite cash in. You know, I talk about a batter, you know, batters within the team, you know, once you've broken the game open, like, take your seat at the all-you-can-eat buffet and don't let it go. And just keep going. And you know, there's no amount of runs that's enough. And I think that's probably one aspect that needs to be, I don't know if you can teach it or it needs to come from within. I think it probably needs to come from within. And I think, you know, I think a lean period of time will breed that. I think, you know, there'll be players that will stand up and they will say, "Right, not on my watch. I'm gonna make sure that I'm gonna be the one that's gonna pull us out of a dark spot."
Yeah, and this is not a comment on effort levels, but I do think that generationally we're at a different spot. So going back to when you came in the game, if Steve Waugh was getting out to the same shot, he'd just say, "All right, I'm gonna put that shot away, and I'm for as long as it takes, and I'm going to stay out in the middle." And I feel like this generation, you know, they're brought up with T20 cricket and, you know, you've got to dominate and keep the scoring going, that, you know, they keep getting out the same ways and not like, okay, well, if I'm going to just keep, you know, edging these flashy cover drives to gully, I'm going to put that shot away for the season so I can average 40 plus at first class level. I can work it into the nets, but when I'm ready, you know, I'm not going to pull it out because, you know, that's what I need to keep my spot.
Yeah, or put it away for an hour when the conditions aren't in your favour. And I think there was a little bit of I'm good enough to be able to play these shots on whatever surface and whatever time, and then, you know, the bad results or the average results start to pile up, and then it's like, oh, I actually don't know how to do this now, and I don't have the belief anymore, and as opposed to just saying, all right, I'm going to be single-minded to put away a drive for an hour or two, or I'm not going to play a pull shot because I get out playing a pull shot regularly. You know, and having that peace of mind and I guess that egoless mentality where you're just saying, you know what, I know I can play that shot, but I'm just not going to play it now. And, you know, I think there's definitely, you know, whether it's a generational thing or or a team thing. I think there's definitely something to be said around that with the team that I was coaching there. But it isn't uncommon around other teams around the country as well. There are a lot of players now with the T20 and the way that the junior formats and junior cricket is being run around Australia that they don't know how to bat time. They don't know how to score long innings and have that peace of mind to say, you know what, I can play these shots, but I'm not going to play them at this phase of the game. I'm going to bring it in after lunchtime, you know, and have the confidence that you will be there you'll be there at lunchtime to be able to cash in. Mm-hmm. And know that you'll catch them up as the day wears on. And that was definitely the mentality when I played and the players that I played with along in that era around their four-day cricket. And I had a lot of success doing that.
Certainly. Well, it's going to be big pressure on the New South Wales team next summer, I think, to bounce back. I guess, Phil, thanks so much for joining me on Cricket Unfiltered, this Menna's Masterclass interview. It's been so great to talk to you. You know, you talked about your Pro Cricket Academy. You know, what else is on the horizon for you?
Yeah, I'm just doing bits and pieces at the moment. You know, open to do little coaching stints wherever that is, and you know, whether that's in Australia or overseas for short periods of time. I've got a young family in Australia. That's you know, my priority is them, and I want to be in Sydney and around my family for the next few years at least, anyway, and until they're a bit older and you know and are able to, you know, to sort of deal without their dad being there for 24/7. But yeah, like I'm really enjoying the academy stuff, and you know, like I'm loving helping the local kids in and around you know, the Sutherland area and around Sydney. I've got a few people coming from around Sydney and from different parts of Sydney to come and get the coaching under me, and yeah, I'm enjoying imparting some of the things that I learned along the way to that generation and helping them be able to achieve their dreams. That's what I'm in the game for.
Well, best of luck with it, Phil. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's been so great to talk to you and go through your career. Congratulations. It's phenomenal achievements in there, and you know, so thrilled to talk to you about them. Thank you.
Thanks, Menas. Thanks for having me on, mate.
This is a Piccolo Podcast production.
Sports Social Podcast Network.